Welcome back to the Discovering Forestry podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Corey Lofi, alongside the Joe Aitken. Joe, happy 4th of July. How are you?
I'm good, Corey. Happy 4th of July. It was an interesting one. You know, it was, I think, a little bit more back like normal. Everybody was outside. Trees are looking good. It felt good to be outside. So, but I'm glad to be back talking to you. Talking trees. We got an amazing guest tonight, so this is going to be fun.
Yeah, let's have a little fun with it. Our guest tonight, she's been everywhere. She's like that Johnny Cash song, I've been everywhere, man. We're going to have a conversation with Dr. Melissa Baker. I originally met her as my advisor and one of my lead professors at the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. And Dr. Baker she's done everything. So, Melissa, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm well, Corey. Thank you. It's so good to be here. It's good to have a chance to talk to you today. And Joe, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
So, Melissa, as we're just getting started here, could you just inform some of our listeners about maybe some of your past career highlights that you've had in forestry and bringing people into the industry as well?
Okay. Well, as you just said, I met you when I was a professor of forest recreation at University of Stevens Point, or University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. And I spent a few years in academia, and then I hopped over into the agency world. So I left university life and went to work for Wisconsin State Forest on the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest, managing their recreation program. And from there, I've been in a few states. So went to Montana as the chief of operations for Montana State Parks, then to North Dakota, where I was director of their Department of Parks and Recreation. And now I am in Virginia, where I am director of Virginia State Parks.
Wow.
Got a few states in there. I like it.
And you worked in Montana before you were even a professor, right?
Yes, I got my PhD at the University of Montana in Missoula from their forestry program.
Hey, shout out to Missoula. We have some listeners that are from up there.
Oh, wonderful. Missoula's a great town.
Oh, it is. And it's one of those towns where that's part of the area, the territory that I service, and there's some really good diehard arborists up there, but they're equally as dedicated and diehard towards their fly fishing.
Oh yes, fly fishing is a way of life in Western Montana.
Well, out of all those places, what would you say would be maybe your favorite place or that you got to experience the most?
You know, each one of those places has had something really, really wonderful about it. Of all of those, I've spent the most time in Wisconsin. So I was 3.5 years at the university and then almost 4 years at the State Forest. And Wisconsin has a way of getting into your soul a bit. So I really loved living in Wisconsin and being part of the community in Wisconsin. But I really feel privileged to be able to go to all of these states and to live there, because each one of them has had just really unique and wonderful things about them. And so picking a favorite's difficult.
Oh, that's a good answer. Joe's in Michigan, so I don't know if you've spent much time there yet, but Joe's proof that that's a pretty good state.
Yeah, we're okay over here. We're okay. Well, Melissa, when we first started talking, I wrote something down. I wanted to ask you. You specialize in forest recreation. Now, to me, I'm thinking having fun in the woods. Let's dive a little bit deeper in what exactly is forest recreation? Is it just because I'm a climber by trade, so I'm thinking setting up a geocache and climbing trees and ringing bells, and it might obviously be a little bit different than what your interpretation of forest recreation is.
Well, in my university life, where I was the professor of forest recreation, primarily what we talked about there was recreating on public lands. So a lot of the parks and recreation world in the university setting where people get their degrees is either through a parks and recreation or outdoor recreation, or in Stevens Point's case, forest recreation, where you talk about truly out recreation that depends on the outdoors for part of the experience. And then the other pathway to parks and recreation management usually comes through health and education programs where they're looking at municipal recreation, your city parks, ball leagues, things like that.
Thank you for shedding a little more light on that. And Corey and I were discussing back, you know, on future podcasts, and I think this ties into great with a lot of state parks and rec individuals are unsung heroes and don't get enough credit for what they do to maintain these parks, especially at a state level with limited funding and all that stuff. And I'll speak for the Michigan DNR Parks and Stewardship Program. I don't think they get enough recognition of what a great job they do to keep these parks open and looking beautiful.
Well, I appreciate your saying that, Joe. You know, parks professionals are really hardworking professionals, and you guys understand this because you work for passion, and parks folks work for passion as well. We do things that we really are passionate about. We believe in protecting the resources that are important to the states. We believe in the recreation opportunities that we provide to people. And, you know, I don't know that there's ever been a year where it has been so obvious the benefits of public land recreation as it has been this year. You know, when everything else was closed, state and national parks were open, municipal parks were open. And I don't know what a lot of people would have done had those parks not been open for people to get out of their houses and have places to recreate safely and to get away from the stress of life.
Well, and you hit it on the head with that, with a couple things, Melissa, that I just really, really want to take note of. Get outdoors and do it safely. You're working, I mean, and in the jobs you've had, you're working on that public nature education, adventure, interface, all of that coming together. So what takes precedence or kind of what is, obviously we want the visitor's experience, right, to be a top priority, but how do you balance safety versus adventure? And then you throw in the current plague that we're going through.
Right. Yeah. The, what takes precedence is always public health and safety. How do we ensure that people can come and enjoy their recreation experience safely, safe for them, safe for others, and then also safe for the resources. So in state parks, national parks are similar. We're protecting areas that are significant. They're significant to the states that we live in. Many of them have long histories or significant environmental resources that we're protecting and we're helping people connect with. And so being able to allow people in and still manage those resources in a way that keeps everyone safe. And one of the things that people don't realize about parks professionals is that we're really managing small cities. So we have in Virginia, over 1,700 buildings in our state park system.
Wow.
So that's almost 2,000 buildings. That is on par with university systems across the state or any other state agency that you can compare it to. We're on up there in the amount of infrastructure we have. And that was just buildings. We have hundreds of miles of roads. We have public drinking water systems. We have public wastewater systems. It's really managing in Virginia. We have 41 state parks and we manage 41 small towns.
Wow. I think there's 103 state parks in Michigan. I think that was the last because Belle Isle was just deemed a state park through an agreement with the city of Detroit. And it's probably, I think it's even larger than Central Park. And if you've never been there, it's pretty amazing. But I think what's interesting when we're coming up with this dialogue is that state parks are really, Corey, you kind of hit on it. It's an interface between arboriculture, urban forestry, and forestry. You have to have all those disciplines in place when you're talking about a state park system or municipal park system to even go a little farther.
Yeah, and there's some big differences. If I put my thinking cap on or maybe check out some of my notes from when Dr. Melissa Baker was at the front of the room. But for folks who don't have that forest rec major, Melissa, what are some of the differences between a state versus a national park? And I think a lot of people kind of confuse and intertwine, but I know there's some budgetary as well as what you're actually permitted to do and how you manage that land.
Yeah, that's a good question. And there are some management implications and certainly budget implications. When you look at the national park system, you look at properties that are significant nationally, either for environmental purposes, landscape purposes, historical purposes. And like the national park system, state parks are designated based on their importance to the state. And sometimes they have national importance as well. When you look at how they are managed and how people experience them, that's another example of how a lot of things are the same and a lot of things are different. So when we talk about recreation, especially outdoor recreation, and Corey's going to have flashbacks to his university days, but we talk about the recreation opportunity spectrum where people go for all different types of recreation. And it takes a variety and network of parks and public lands to provide those. So some people want really developed settings. Some people need really developed settings based on their physical abilities to be able to engage in the outdoors. And some people want a true wilderness, get away from everything experience. And from municipal parks to state parks to national parks, they all live on that spectrum from historic sites where you might go in and have heavy interpretive experiences to camping in organized campgrounds to putting a backpack on your back and hiking out miles from the trailhead to experience nature. Those are all types of experiences that people come to parks to look for, and they expect and operate within the expectations of different levels of service. So for instance, with y'all's specific interest in arboriculture and tree care, if you think about what people might reasonably expect in the different recreation areas, if you're in a developed area, a picnic area, a developed campground in a state park where people bring their RVs, you would have a expectation that we're watching the trees, we're monitoring for hazard trees, we're taking care of any hazards that are there. We're constantly evaluating, do we have enough shade in campgrounds and recreation areas? What's the balance between manicured areas where people can lay out their picnic blankets versus tree cover and privacy or screening vegetation? I'm in those developed spaces. And then the further you get away from developed spaces, the less the expectation is that you're that involved with individual trees. And so when you get to those far backcountry sites, then they're really in places where nature is taking its course.
Yeah, so there's a wide gamut of experiences available. Yeah, because I was very fortunate to hike into the Porcupine Mountains. It's a wilderness state park in
there.
Well, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it was 2 years ago this summer where we had authorized by the Michigan DNR to preserve two of the largest black ash trees in North America. And the amazing thing about that hike back, and you talk about different experiences, most of the hikers that go through that are all on the trail system. But because we were working with the state, we got the GPS off the trail system into, in the center of that park is 20 acres of virgin forest that nobody really knows where it's at. and that's where the trees were. So we had a GPS off trail, like 2.5 miles in, and that was like stepping back in time. And again, I can't tell anybody where it's at because we don't want no one to visit it, because it is, you know, if everybody knows that it's there, everybody's going to go. So it's not that it's taboo, no one can find it, but they just don't want a bunch of people knowing exactly where it is. So you're right, there's a lot of beautiful things that they could see, and you're right, or they want to go to a park with a bunch of playgrounds and go home at the end of the day.
You know, and one of the things that sometimes people who like one type of recreation over the other don't always capture or don't always think about is that it's really having all of those experiences that supports the whole system. So if you're a person who really likes large landscape recreation, you like backpacking, you like getting into the far, far into the wilderness, and those places are important to you, if you want them to be important to others, they have to be able to interact with nature in a way that is comfortable and safe for them. And so many people who end up backpacking, they didn't start backpacking. They started in their city park, and then they went to their state park, and then they went to the front country of their national park. And then as they got more and more comfortable with the outdoors, they could go further and further into the wilderness and into adventure. And so it really does take the system and understanding how you're going to manage the setting in each part of the system, from very strong management to very minimal management, to provide those experiences is part of that. And so, you know, sometimes I'll hear folks say, well, I don't camp in organized campgrounds, or they don't do the developed areas, but the developed areas are really where you get the support for the wilderness areas as well.
That's a great point financially. You're right. And then they'll work their way up, right? What's it called? The Appalachian Trail?
The Appalachian Trail.
Yeah. When you hit the, what's it, 3 months to get through or something like that?
Not if you run. Not if you run, Joe.
No, don't run, though.
Well, no. And you, Melissa, you talked about the interaction between the guest, the RVD, right? Yeah, Recreational Visitor Day, the RVD, and the environment. But something that, and I spend a lot of time mountain biking and skiing and camping and hiking and all that out here in Colorado. Something that I really would like to hear you speak to is just some of the interaction amongst the guests. You know, there's always that rival between the mountain biker and the hiker, and the hiker and the horse. As somebody who's managing such a large, vast area, I mean, you just want everybody to be happy, right?
Right, you do. And so much of that has to do with expectation. So if people know what to expect whenever they get on a trail, and you used a good example of a place that we often hear about conflict, horse, bike, foot traffic on a trail. If you know what to expect and you know folks are out there, then that helps. Because if you don't know that you've got multiple uses and you come upon a use that you don't think should be there, then that you can perceive of that as negative. But the other piece of that is not just knowing who's out there and knowing what to expect, but it's helping people to understand the needs of the other recreationists. And we see that a lot whenever it comes to mountain biking and horse, because mountain bikers can move so quickly, and well-developed trails have really nice bends and mystery and things like that. But when you round a bend really quickly and you come upon a horse, it can spook the horse. And so when you're designing trails, and then also when you're thinking of the rules for those trails, you have to keep those things in mind. How do you educate people so that they know other people on their trail? How do you help them understand what the other groups need? And are there some design features that you can put into trails that can minimize that? So for instance, in North Dakota, we had a trail system that had bikers and horse riders on there. And there was one place that bikers tended to surprise the horses most. And so what we were working on there is, could we, for that section, we didn't have enough, we didn't have ability to create completely separate trail systems, But for that one section, could we create different portions of the trail that could separate those uses? And so thinking about what each group needs.
Yeah, I remember as you're saying this, all of those, that 4.5 years of university, it's, I'm just waiting for Melissa to say Kawita dip. Because I remember we talked about that in our for folks who don't know what a Kawita dip is, go ahead and Google it. We're just going to laugh our butts off over here, though.
I'm thinking I'm going to step into another direction on the park system, something that I don't think is utilized or people realize is that there's a valuable resource that help out with parks in municipal, state, and national called volunteers. Getting involved, like a nonprofit. What we've been trying to do here in the Midwest has been trying to get specialized services. A lot of state agencies don't have arborists that are designed to climb and rope and saddle. So I think it would be interesting if there was a way that we connect park systems to their local ISA chapter, which International Society of Arboriculture, for days of service on state parks to be doing tree work that park staff isn't certified to do. Melissa, what do you think of that? Do you think that there's a need, or is this something that we could do to benefit? Because Corey and I we love climbing still. I know our day-to-day is plant health care and keeping trees safe, but we all know it's a living organism that could fail that we have to take care of. But is there, I don't see a strong enough link between that volunteer group and specialized services.
So I liked it well enough that while you were saying it, I was writing it down because I think that's a great idea. If you've been involved with parks at all, and I know Joey that you said you have, and Corey, I know you have, you know just how critical volunteers are. Park systems, there's not one that I know of that could exist without their volunteers for purposes of resources and staffing levels. This idea of specialized services and partnering with folks who can do things that park staff can't do, I think that's worth exploring. Now the government employee in me says, okay, now what are all the risks associated with that and how do we compensate for them? But what I found is that as long as you know what you're trying to shoot for, it might take a little work to find the path, but you can usually find the path to yes.
And I
go ahead.
Melissa, that's spot on. And I know it's going to be different once again, if you're looking state versus a national park. For instance, I live right outside Rocky Mountain National Park. I'm 15 minutes away, and we had Colorado's fastest growing, second largest wildfire in history last year hit it. And as an arborist, somebody who's on, ISA, so International Society of Arboriculture, as a registered arborist, they were looking for people on this side of the mountains that could help. And that was a volunteer opportunity where, I was in there, but every single tree with that national park had to be accounted for and had to be given an okay. Even though I could address it and saying, hey, there's a structural weak point there, or obviously it's fallen and it's obstructed the road. Can we go ahead and remove this for whatever reason? But there's a whole system and process in place. And I'm with you. I think that would be a really cool direction to see how we could kind of link the two and see if we couldn't help each other in some way.
Yeah. And there are events that happen in parks throughout the country like that. We are currently monitoring the tropical weather season. Being on the East Coast, we're always watching for that. And invariably we have storms come through that end up taking a lot of time to clear. And in fact, we had an ice storm, and ice storms are perfect examples of the knowledge that y'all have. because we had so much tree failure this year. So we had a bad ice storm come through, and a lot of places in the South have those. And we cleaned for well over a week on just a few parks that were hardest hit with the ice storm. And so there's lots of times whenever you would find opportunities like that.
That's great. And I think Joe, I think it was a great idea. Melissa, you know, if anybody's going to make it happen, it's you. I remember volunteering with the forest rec class up at that park in northern Wisconsin. I think we built some signs or something. It was, you know, it was fun. Mm-hmm. But as we're tying things together, and I really want to just, you know, use you kind of here as a great resource. What advice would you have to people as they're trying to get into forestry or forest recreation? Some didn't even know that it was a thing until you brought it up today. So what advice do you have for them?
And I think that's a place where the work that I do in forest recreation, outdoor recreation, overlaps with the work that y'all do, especially arboriculture and once you climb a tree. So those are both discovery fields. I know a lot of people who became urban foresters because of tree climbing classes, and it gets in your blood and you want to do that. And that's true of recreation too. So a lot of people that get into natural resources, they love being outdoors, but like me, whenever I first started into my degree programs in recreation, I knew that people did those jobs, but I had never really thought about making a career of it myself or what you would study to do it. And so I would say that people who are exploring their career path should look at both of these professions. If you're in college, look at classes and get some exposure. You might find something that you're really, really passionate about. And if you're in doubt, as Joe said, there's lots of volunteer opportunities. So you can actually get in the field and decide if this is a culture, if this is a type of work that you would want to do your career in. And that works really well for me, right? Because most people who come into parks and do work catch the bug.
Oh, yeah.
And they do want to do that work for the rest of their life, because when you get to do that thing that you're really passionate about, work days go pretty, pretty fast.
So that does. We, as we're wrapping up, Corey and I both feel exactly what you said. Once you get that bug, or Corey and I call ourselves tree nerds because we just love it so much, that we actually had a podcast where we brought in not a psychic, but a good friend of mine that does tarot carding to try to figure out, is there a connection between the people that are in the green industry and not? And it was pretty interesting, but you're going to have to tune into that episode to hear what we said. And both Corey and I came to conclusion that, yes, there is a electrical connection between the people in this industry and the parks and the trees and the people that aren't, and you are drawn to serve in this industry.
You know, I would agree with that. And I would also say that I can't tell you that I've ever experienced anyone that has said finding a career that has to do with the outdoors wasn't a really positive thing in their life. Those of us who are able to do that, we're really, really lucky to be able to spend our lives in this type of work. And so what I would say to people who are exploring it is get out there, find places to volunteer. If you're in school, use your summer jobs in your field, because that's how you really truly know. And don't be afraid to reach out and network and get to know people and ask them questions, because most of us are so excited about the work that we do that if you ask us about it, we're going to be excited to tell you about it.
Yep. Yes, you're right. Why is it?
You'll hop on a podcast at 10 o'clock at night because you're passionate about it, Melissa. And we're so grateful at everything you just put out there. If we could go back in time and someone could slap me over the back of the head with what you said, the summer internship, the networking, be curious and just get out there and do it. Oh, you would have saved, that would have saved a lot of headaches, but learning opportunities.
Well, you know, in my career, so I've been a professor and I have also been at multiple levels of government agencies. And what I can tell you is that without question, if you have been in the field and you have been a good employee and you have a good reputation, the likelihood that you're going to be successful in that career path has increased multifold, because these communities are small. They're small groups of people. We know each other. And if you get a good reference from someone that we know that has good judgment in people, then you're a safe bet for a hire. And so I've seen that in every single system, that if you go in and you work hard in the seasonal jobs, the likelihood that you transition into a full-time job is so much better.
That's awesome.
Correct. Awesome.
Thank you again so much for being here. On a very personal note, thank you so much for the advising and the teaching you did to get me to wherever it is I am today. I mean, truly, you know, you were a big part of it. So thank you for that. And really look forward to seeing you again.
Well, I appreciate that, Corey. And it has really been my pleasure. And I have to tell you, I have two pictures of people in my office that have gone with every office move I've made. That picture of me and you at graduation is still in my office.
Get out.
It is.
Who's the other one? Brad Pitt?
No, my husband.
Oh, how is Dean?
He's good.
Oh, good. Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you again so much. We're going to hit the end button here, but really, really, really appreciate you being here.
It was my pleasure.
Hey, great topic today.
Yes, and lots of good information.
Yeah, probably one of our best yet.
If you enjoyed the podcast or have topics you would like to discuss, please send them to discoveringforestry@gmail.com. And please hit the subscribe button and tell a friend.
Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Joe.
And I'm Corey.
Signing out.